everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of your favorite queer movie podcast, Queens of the Bees. I am your podcast co-host, TJ, a very flamboyantly queer Pisces, and this is my co-host.
Oh, me?
Yes, you.
I am your co-host, Mark Muster, a very queer Leo, I guess. Sorry, I'm a little tired today, listeners.
he's definitely not straight acting, whatever his voice might suggest.
My sexy voice, you mean?
Your sexy voice, yes. Listeners have informed me on numerous occasions.
I've heard listeners that you want more of my sexy voice, so I'm here to give it to you.
Whereas I'm here to give you your daily dose of just queer voice. So
listen, we need all voices and perspectives on this podcast, TJ.
Yeah, but sometimes it'd be nice to be the sexy one.
Well, no one says you're not sexy. And I also think that part of the great beauty of your voice is it makes mine sexier. By contrast.
Wow, talk about giving with one hand and taking with the other.
It's a gift.
Anyway.
It was raised by water signs, you know. It's a gift.
Anyway, we thank you all for joining us for another great
episode. What did we watch this week?
We watched a film called Stonewall. Not the disgraceful Roland
Despicable,
Emmerich
disgraceful,
one.
Disgraceful. Detrimental. Disgusting.
That has like a 10% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which we will do in a later episode, I think.
No, I don't want to watch it again.
Well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. For today, we're going to be talking about the 1995 version, which is a production of the BBC, which is, in my opinion, a far superior film for a whole host of reasons that we'll get to.
I mean, the bar is low.
That is true. That is a pretty low bar. So that is what we will be talking about today. Mm-hmm. And since I was the one who chose the film and had seen it several times before, I will let Marcus be the one to give us the 15-word or less summary. Which, I mean, the summary's kind of in the title, so I don't know.
I was going to say Stonewall.
That's cheating, so you have to give a better summary than
okay,
that.
Okay, fine. Drag queen meets Southern boy. Meets interracial drag couple. Meets oppression and early gay rights movement. That was 14.
Yeah, that's actually pretty
good.
I think that's probably the best summary I've heard you give of a movie.
I'm going to delete all the pauses in between, so it sounds like I had it ready to go.
I think that's also cheating.
It's not cheating if no one gets
to me. I mean, part of the fun is putting you on the spot and making you come up with a summary.
Fine, I'll leave it in. Okay, let's get into it, TJ. So, I think right off the bat, I want to bring up the fact that everybody is horrible at acting in this movie. Everybody's horrible at acting. It's really pretty bad. For the listeners, I started watching this movie and then immediately texted TJ and was like, this is horrible. And we did not see eye to eye, but...
Okay, so I have a couple things to say.
Already, I didn't even finish my point.
Go ahead.
The acting is finish. Bad. It takes away
is that
from...
it?
Yeah.
So, I just want to point out two things. One, it's not nearly as bad as Marcus would have us believe. I think he was just cranky when he started watching
this
movie.
No, I'm cranky today.
And secondly, it's funny to me that you're pointing out how bad the acting is in this movie, whereas you gave so much credit to Love the One You're With, which also had bad acting, but you didn't seem to be as obsessed with the bad acting.
Okay, well, Love
that,
the One...
Which is...
Yeah, go ahead.
Which has demonstrably bad acting.
Okay, Love the One You're With had a lot of issues, okay? And also, it did not have the backing of the BBC, all right? So, you know, this could have been better. People could have been... Not everybody was bad at acting. Bostonia was very good. Vinny was also actually pretty good.
Yeah.
The main characters were not.
So La Miranda and Maddie Dean are the two sort of main characters. La Miranda is a drag queen, of the streets of New York. Maddie Dean is a Southern. We're led to believe that he's of upper class or at least wealth.
I mean, yeah, he's a white gay.
Yeah, so, the way, well, the not every, these days, not every white gay in the South is rich. Not every white gay in the South is rich.
That is true. That is definitely true. I will give listeners, if you've seen the more recent Stonewall movie, this is basically that movie, just with all the people of color put back in.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that what makes this movie better than its successor, with the same exact same title, mm-hmm. is that as much as Matty Dean is an important character, and I think serves a pretty important narrative and sort of historical function as a character, it's not his story primarily. In fact, the film opens with both a sort of montage of documentary footage of Stonewall and its aftermath and how people perceived it in the after it happened, and that it set the stage and was sort of the last great riot of the 60s mm-hmm. after the Rice Riots and all that. But also with La Miranda's voiceover, and which makes it clear that this film is going to be her story mm-hmm. and her particular recollection, which deeply personalizes this sort of important social moment, like this, you know, this moment that became an epochal event,
yes.
is very much a personal story of a Latinx drag queen.
Yes.
I think that that's, which is so important and so much different than the 2000 and whatever Stonewall by Emmerich. Like, it's just so, I mean, right there off the bat, it just shows us what this movie's investments are going to be and whose stories are getting told. And I mean, I think that's really important, and why this film is still important, you know, now 25 years after it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's one of the few docudramas that really does sort of provide a complicated mosaic of the Stonewall riots and in the milieu that they rose out of, more to the point.
Yeah, okay, I will relent a little that near the end of the film I did kind of come around to its worth.
Mm-hmm.
How should I put this? I like that you brought that, you kind of redeemed it for me a little bit with this idea that La Miranda is our main character and she tells us her story, right? Because in the very beginning, the song is really her kind of saying, like, there are many stories about Stonewall, right, that you're going to hear, and we get interludes of all of that. So what's great about this is La Miranda and Matty Dean, like you said, were more mirrored characters, where La Miranda is the main character and Matty Dean is a secondary character who basically brings us into the other, another, as you said, scope of queer organizing, which I think is really, really good. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, let me preface this by saying I have not actually watched the Emmerich version yet. I was so turned off by the...
Oh, you haven't seen it?
I have not.
Oh, it is so bad.
Okay, so you have seen it?
I saw it when it came out.
Okay.
And I was just like, who knew the story of Stonewall, but I had not seen this other film, so I did not know that the two were connected, was watching it and being like, what the hell is going on? Like, this didn't happen.
Right.
And the gays around me did not understand, but that's okay.
Right. So what I'm about to say is just gleaned from, you know, reading the summaries of the Emmerich version and the reviews, is that whereas the Emmerich version very much foregrounds the white male character as sort of the engine of history around which everything revolves and the whole story is about him, Matty Dean is a cast member in La Miranda's story. Like, yes. Their romance is the most important part of the story, but he's not... We're not sutured into his perspective to the degree that we are with La Miranda's. Now, that being said, he does play an important role as both a character in the terms that he's her love interest, but also as a historical figure because he has the ability to move between these two queer spaces of pre-Stonewall New York. One, the Stonewall Inn and the sort of, you know, drag culture. And then on the other, he attends meetings of the Mattachine. For our listeners who may not know, the Mattachine Society was a group of what we call like homophile organizations of the 50s and 60s that were all about like mainstreaming, to use today's parlance, like gay organizing. So to make it clear that gays were just like everybody else, to win in the courtrooms and all that sort of thing. There's even a scene where they invite a medical doctor to come talk about how homosexuals are really pathological and that even then they can they can use that to get sympathy. And so Matty, you know, befriends and becomes lovers with one of them who's an English teacher or professor who's obviously pretentious and terrible.
Yeah.
But the reason Matty Dean's important is because he's sort of the character that can move in both spaces.
Yes.
even though he's not a main character, I think it's important that he shows us as viewers from the 90s what life was like for queer people in the 60s, which, you know, was either in the subversive sort of counterculture of the drag bar or the more homophile political organizing. So there's sort of two sort of broadly construed queer areas of life that Maddie can give us insight into. And I think that's really what helps, I think, makes the film have a lot of value from a perspective from a 90s and even a 2021 perspective, is that it helps us to see this sort of pivotal moment of pre-Stonewall history in a way that's obviously deeply personal as well, since it also, the divide between the Mattachine and the drag culture gets mapped onto Maddie's romance with La Miranda and Ethan. And so that's the sort of way that the personal and the political and the historical all get intertwined with each other in mm-hmm. a way that I think is really, really interesting and rich.
Yeah, sure. I like that he has a utility. No, everything you said was right. I just think that the fact that he has a utility and is not just, like, pretty and white is really my favorite part. Mm-hmm. We also have to, like, let's start with him so we can forget about him, so we don't have to worry about him anymore. So fast forward, listeners, if you want to get to, like, the better characters. But my favorite part about Maddie is, as a young white queer who just got back from Fire Island, I loved that they make fun of Fire Island so explicitly for being a basic rich white mess. Okay, it was unaffordable from the start. And, like, even Maddie, who is very white in the Stonewall space, right, shows himself to be uncomfortable in the Fire Island space. And so in that sense, you get, like, this middle ground kid who kind of wants to be with La Miranda and wants to be part of the more radical queer spaces, right, and is very, disjointed with the kind of white rich gays who are, like, hanging out on the beach. You know, and Ethan, who is the lover who takes him there, right, is compromising his queerness to be part of this, like, very basic space. Mm-hmm. So I loved how explicitly they made fun of Fire Island.
Yeah, I mean, because there's so experience there. Right, because, you know, they're not allowed to, because of archaic laws, they're not allowed to, like, show revealing bathing wear on the beach. At the dance they have to wait till the girl starts the dance, dancing. Yeah. And even there, they're not literally allowed to be intimate with each other. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting for two reasons. One, as you point out, the class distinction, because Ethan's like, oh, Maddie, who cares? Just, like, take a break from your
dishwashing. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, he's like, just take off on Friday and we'll go for, like, a weekend, you know? That's so easy to do.
Mm-hmm. And then also, but twofold, it strikes me, it's interesting that you talked about, like, the fakery of Fire Island, because that's so juxtaposed to, like, the emotional richness of Stonewall.
Yeah.
Like, which is painted as and depicted as a space where, obviously, it's subject to raids by the police, and it's obviously under the control of the organized crime families, but it's still a space where people could be their own, where the people are at least authentic, ironically enough, for people dressing in drag, it's deeply authentic, like, people mm-hmm. can be their actual selves. Mm-hmm. And so I like that juxtaposition of those two worlds. And it's where Maddie feels more comfortable, because his feelings for La Miranda are so much more authentic than they are. Because at least she has that's not exactly what I was going to say. I was going to use a very unfortunate turn of phrase. Mm-hmm. At least she has the bravery and the fortitude to live her life as she chooses.
Yeah.
As opposed to Ethan and the Mattachine, who are not, and who try to fit into a society that still has no place for them, which is made clear when they go to the Philadelphia, you know, protest, and they're marching in front of Independence Hall, and you see the disgusted looks of the onlookers, and it, you know, it comes across feeling very anticlimactic, because it is.
Yes, exactly. They're wearing suits, they're trying to look normal, and they're holding the American flag and walking in a circle, you know, not really chanting. It's showing, like, the idea. It's very much the idea, which I really like, is that, like, being an activist and activism requires provoking and requires a little edge, right? A little more danger, because the point is to be seen, right? If you're trying to be seen by becoming invisible or assimilating, you will not be seen. That's, like, the point. But I also really... Did you want to retort to that, Mr. Moderate?
First of all, I want to point out for our listeners that may mischaracterize me as a moderate, that mm-hmm. I am not, that I have just as radical a philosophy as other more straightforwardly radical queers, mm-hmm. and I get very, very irritated when people paint me as a moderate, even though I am not, and that I just feel that that's a mischaracterization. And right. I think that it's a simplistic attack, like an often ad hominem attack that seeks to delegitimize what I'm actually saying mm-hmm. by painting me in a way that is not fair. I mean, okay. That's happened to me many times, and I just want to go on record as pointing that out, that okay. I think it's actually more complicated, as life is often much more complicated. And I was actually going to say, I hope that someday we get a movie that actually paints the Mad Machine in a bit more complicated light, because I do think that, you know, that we live in a world where winning court battles is important and gets us a lot of rights and privileges sure. that we didn't have. And if it weren't for the Mad Machine and other more assimilationist groups, that we wouldn't have those. So I just think that it's important we point that out. Sure. But I also sure. think the film the film's not entirely ungenerous to the Mad Machine. Like, yeah. it's, you know, I mean, they definitely come out looking a little bit sillier than the sort of subversives at the Stonewall. But I think that there's a generous moment when their, you know, their leader is dancing with Bostonia, one of the drag queens, at the Stonewall. And it's a pretty human portrait. Like, he admits that he's kind of I think he refers to himself as like a vanilla gay, mm-hmm. that he's never really done anything adventurous. But Bostonia is sort of one of the voices of the film that I think is imbued with a lot of authority and a lot of, you know, compassion. She's like, you know, I like you, and I think that you're doing important work, too, is the implication yes. of their conversation. And so I think that that's part, again, I think there's just so much richness and texture to this film and the way that it really helps to sort of tease out how complicated and how variegated the gay movement has always been, and how it's not, you know, it doesn't easily break down, or should I say, beneath the seemingly simple binary of assimilation versus subversive, there's often a lot of wiggle room and a lot of gray area that's worth exploring.
Yeah, I think the film does a pretty good job of showing all the different sides of that and how there aren't just two, there are quite a few, and also how people get trapped being able to move through different parts and those who have access and those who don't. The thing that I was going to say about the Mad Machine, one last thing about Fire Island, what I thought was interesting was the way policing works mm-hmm. in both the spaces. So at the Stonewall, the more subversive space, the police are violent, abusive, you know, they sexually abuse the queens, they mm-hmm. hurt them and things like that. And on Fire Island, very white, very male, very rich, it's about covering up your swimsuit. I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I like mm-hmm. that. I mean, especially because, I mean, the opening sequence is all about, like, the raid on, you know, a raid on the Stonewall, mm-hmm. and where they do some pretty horrifying things. Like, they dunk La Miranda's head in the water because she won't, like, just sort of
go. The dirty hepatitis-filled water.
Yeah, she won't yes. go along to get along. And so it's a pretty yeah. horrifying, I mean, it's a pretty wrenching sequence, like,
yeah, it was hard to watch. And actually, I for the listeners, I don't know if anyone was, but I was just reading Stone Butch Blues for Pride, and there are a lot of scenes of police raids at a lot of gay bars up in Buffalo, mm-hmm. and they are, it's so, like, Stone Butch Blues is not a memoir, but of course it is a conglomeration and mm-hmm. a fiction of real stories, you know, about being gay, but I think it's, like, the uncanny resemblance of mm-hmm. the way that these stories of police violence are told back then and the raids and stuff is truly insane, right? To the point where it's kind of very overwhelming to not feel for these people a lot. I was just being hit from a lot of angles with this. It was really crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things that Stonewall really highlights for us living in the present is, well, first of all, how quickly things have advanced. Like, even by the 90s, like, things were, you know, had seen a lot of progress. Not as much as we've seen in the last 10 years, certainly. But, you know, I think that that's one of the things this film highlights, is just how quickly things do march, can march in history. But also, mm-hmm. it highlights just how fucking awful gay life could be.
Yeah.
In America, pre-1969. Like, mm-hmm. I think that it's very easy for, especially for us younger people, like, who don't know anything
us
about that.
Younger
people who didn't grow up in the 50s, which, contrary to what Mark might like you to believe, I did not live in the 50s. But it was, I mean, every institution of American life, from the government to, you know, civic organizations, to your neighbors, to the obviously the police, were deeply homophobic. Like, And it's, I think it's in the military, which this film also highlights, because La Miranda gets a draft notice and then shows up to her draft hearing in drag. And then, but then has to go for a psychiatric hearing, which also highlights the extent to which, like, homosexuality was deeply pathologized by the psychiatric and psychological communities.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And she has already been... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, maybe we should dwell there, because it's a very interesting scene. I don't know, think the film actually gives it enough of a moment. It seems to be a success, right? So for the listeners, it's actually really, it's the part of the film where I was like, oh, maybe this is going to be fun, because La Miranda and Maddie Dean show up at her draft hearing or whatever, and La Miranda's in drag, and Maddie Dean pretends to be her, I mean, they are boyfriends at the time, and goes up and tries to be like, be very even more flamboyant than she usually is, very hippie, very yada, yada, yada. And they send her to the psychiatric evaluation, to which she's too nervous to basically be herself enough to become a sexual deviant, and because she's not, right? But so Maddie Dean puts on the drag and pretends to be her and does it over the top, right? It's really interesting that the more passing queer acts out to get the psychiatric disqualification from the draft. But I also know that becoming a sexual deviant by the military means that the government has now named you and put a file on you becoming a sexual deviant. That means that she's not going to be able to work. That means that she may not be able to find housing. That means that a lot of things for her future that kind of this little act of resistance does not dwell on, which is really dangerous. I mean, and choosing... So what I'm trying to say, I think, is that the film plays this off as a comedic relief and kind of a middle finger to the government and war, but that, in fact, choosing not to die in Vietnam might mean choosing to die at home from, like, starvation, you know? That those are still two really, really hard choices for people pre-Stonewall.
Yep, and I love the part that, and how that, there's an allusion to her trauma, because she mentions that she was sent to a psychiatrist as a child, like, I think she says 11 when she was in juvenile hall, and she says, you know, they were going to do electroshock therapy, like, that's the reality. I mean, that was the reality for a lot of gay people, some of whom chose to self-medicate, because, you know, why wouldn't you, if you're constantly told you're a monster and a dangerous deviant, like, why wouldn't you want to correct yourself? So I mean, it's a blip, and it's a very brief moment, but I think it really highlights the reality of an entire world that thinks of you as evil and or sick, which neither one is particularly good. Like, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And that's, again, I mean, I think it's really hard. I mean, I know that there's still parts of our world that think that way, but I think it's just one of those things that it's very hard for those of us who grew up in a different era, where a different, like, sort of framework of understanding of what gayness means, it's hard for us to really grasp. I mean, even by the 90s, like, when you were born and when I was coming of age, like, that wasn't the same. Like, I just think it's one of those things that we really need to really wrap our heads around, how different that historical moment is from our own and when we were coming of age. Like, you can just imagine the trauma that both Maddie Dean and La Miranda grew up in. There are allusions to it. You know, La Miranda has that part where she's telling Maddie, like, well, when you're rich, they can just try to cure you, but when you're poor, your family takes you out and tries to beat the sexuality out of you.
Yeah.
And that was a really beautiful but also haunting line that really has so much depth to it.
Yeah, there is a parallel I'm going to make for those who have not watched season 2 of Love, Victor, but one day we will have to watch it. I am not finished with the show yet, but there's a really good episode, actually, where Victor, and for those who don't know, this is the remake, this is the TV show kind of extension of Love, Simon, where a Latinx main character who is a little bit, who is lower to middle class, middle class, let's say, in a very rich neighborhood, has come out in high school, and it's kind of his trials and tribulations. And then the second season, he has a white boyfriend who's very rich, Benji. I don't know where the actor is, but anyway, they have a fight because Benji doesn't like that his mother has a lot of issues with them being queer. And part of the reason why she has issues, you find out earlier, is because of their culture, right? Like, her Latinx background and what she was brought up in. And she basically explains this to him. And it's a moment where those two get to bond. And it's funny because there's another character who is queer in the show who is Muslim from Iran. And him and Victor, when Benji and Victor are having a fight, him and his name is Rahim, and Rahim and Victor are together, and Victor just goes, oh, he doesn't get it because, like, you know, he's so, and Rahim goes, he's so white, you know? And it's interesting to the parallel of, you know, it's not as easy that different cultures will see queerness differently, accept it differently, yada, yada, yada. That is in this movie in 1995 and all the way up to 2020, like that would be a theme in queerness that we still struggle with, that is still present, so much so to be in art from the 1990s and in 2021 is really wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, that's why, you know, despite your initial animosity toward this film, I thought once
animosity is a strong word.
I don't know. I think saying this movie is horrible is can be easily
the acting is really bad.
We've covered that already. We can move on from the bad acting.
Sorry.
And it's not that bad. I mean, for an independent movie from a largely independent
movie. The BBC paid for it!
It's still an independent film. And like,
please, okay, whatever I mean, independent film means these days.
Just because it has some funding from the BBC doesn't mean that it's not still...
Their name
like,
is on it.
That it's still moving through the channels of independent cinema.
All right, well...
I mean, especially considering the fact that it's produced by Christine Vachon, who is, you know...
Who?
Noted... who is noted as being one of the key movers and shakers of independent queer cinema in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Having produced like the work of Todd Haynes, Boys Don't Cry, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and so forth. So I just think that's important to point out.
That makes it less independent or more
independent? More independent. That's its credibility, and so therefore one has to like temper one's expectations as far as acting goes.
I was not expecting that.
But anyway, we don't need to keep going on about acting. The movie is much more than just the acting.
Yes, it is. It is. Okay, what else do you want to talk about, TJ? You want to talk about Bustonia and Vinny?
We can talk about Bustonia and Vinny. So in addition to the sort of central sort of romantic arc between, the sort of love triangle, if you will, between Maddie and Ethan and La Miranda, there's also another less central but still, I think, very important romance between Bustonia, who's a, you know, sort of exquisitely... made-up drag queen, and a local mobster named Vinny. And it's very clear, like, it only becomes clear just how complicated their relationship is, because Bustonia is the one who bails out La Miranda and Ethan after they get thrown in prison after the opening sequence. Yes. And then she only gets a few scenes, but man, oh day, does she rock in all the scenes in which she appears. And if I have one complaint about this movie, it's that we didn't get more time with her as a character, because I love her. And she's actually played by Dwayne, I think it's Boot, B-O-U-T-T-E, mm-hmm. who our listeners might remember was actually in Brother to Brother. Mm-hmm. So he plays the young Bruce Nugent in that movie and is equally amazing here. But what I loved about this is that, you know, it's clear that these two people love each other, and it has echoes of, like, Pose. If our listeners have seen Pose, they know that it's about, you know, ball culture, two decades later. But it also has moments where, like, you have... trans women and or drag queens falling in love with mobsters or older Johns, which is basically how the purpose Vinny serves for Bostonia. And it becomes clear later on that he wants her to have, you know, what we call now gender confirmation surgery, so that she can live as a woman and he can live as like a quote unquote normal man, and they can sort of live their life together. But she, as she puts it to him, she's like, I'm a chick with a dick who's not tired of their dick yet. And I love that line because it really captures the complexity of the gender identities of these people
mm-hmm.
that are, you know, that make the Stonewall home, which, you know, you don't always see that in these kinds of movies. And I just love that she's very open about her identity. She's not willing to change for him. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's very clear that he loves her in his own way as violent. But he's imprisoned in like a jail of masculinity, of particular kind of like mobster masculinity.
Yes.
That he ultimately can't escape from, which is why in the end he kills himself. Yes. And so
rather dramatically.
Yeah. By like leaving her a ton of money.
Yes.
But that's soaked with blood. It's a whole gruesome and deeply tragic scene. Like it's really wrenching. And that's what, you know, so I love their relationship and I love how complicated it is and how, you know, it could easily be seen as like a doomed queer narrative, but I'm not sure how you could have anything else in like 1969 New York City.
I mean, I wasn't expecting them to go off into the sunset. And in fact, he needs to die because that's the impetus for her to throw the first brick, right? I mean,
yeah, she punches the cop. She's the first. She's
she
the
punches
one who
throws the cop. Sorry. Is she, yeah. Does she throw a brick too? I forget.
She might. But I mean, more importantly, she punches the cop.
Yeah,
and,
she like, punches the cop and kind of starts the riot.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is very good. I didn't want them to go off into the sunset. I just think shooting yourself next to your lover in bed's a little dramatic.
Yeah.
While money, like, flitters.
And he has painted "I love you" and lipstick on the,
yeah,
on the mirror.
Like, what serial killer shit is this? Like, I just imagined the young PA, like, having to throw money behind the stage so that you can see it. Anyway, it was, I mean, this, the even more tragic part, too, is that it seemed to be finally an accepting moment for them, in which she says to Vinny, like, this is who I am, and you need to accept me as I am, and that you need to accept yourself as who you are, right? And in response, it's a little violent, but in response, he basically says, let's go, we're gonna go get ice cream, and they go to a very fancy restaurant, and they get ice cream, all the ice cream.
And they make out.
And they make out furiously, which, because it's very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the way I think the film is showing it to us, it's actually not, so Bostoni is passing pretty well for a little bit. And it's actually, I don't think the fact that Bostonia can't pass, it's that their furious making out draws a lot of attention. So it is the public affection of queer love, in a sense, that causes people to look and look closely and then find out what's really going on. I think also race is part of it, too.
Yeah, because someone says something to the effect of, like, it's an awfully muscular woman, I think,
yes,
is what they say.
Yeah. And then that's why they get asked to leave, which kind of spirals Vinny into what brings him to kill himself. But it's so interesting that it is not about, because the film does not let us be like, is Bostonia passing? Like, is, mm-hmm, she seems to be doing fine. They're having a great time. In fact, they've been there a very, very long time. It's the fact that they choose to publicly display their affection, right? The idea that queer love might exist outside of Stonewall or in, like, closed off spaces, which is very much the impetus behind the riot to begin with,
mm-hmm,
right? You see that in public. And you see how people look at it, and that causes Vinny to kill himself, it causes them to get kicked out, and causes Bostonia's rage, which is directly tied to why she punches the cop. So that's, like, a brilliant thread that film is able to do.
Yeah,
so
what
maybe
I
did like this film, so there you go.
Yeah, I mean, because what I love about that, and I love it that, in fact, it's a black woman, who, mm-hmm, or a black trans woman, or I don't know if it's really accurate to say she's trans, but whatever, you know.
Drag queen of color, whatever you want to say.
Yeah, whatever. Because these are all terms that I think are anachronistic, so it's hard to actually, like, pin them,
yeah,
down, which is what we can talk about next, which I want to talk about, like, the ambiguities of gender. But for the moment, I love that she's the one, because the cop is taunting her, being like, she doesn't know whether to something or cry, and she's like, you know what? Fuck. She's like, basically, like, fuck this, and then clobbers him right in the,
yeah,
face.
He says, are you going to punch me, or are you going to, like,
cry
or something? Yeah.
She's like, I guess I decided. And,
yeah,
I love that, because it's such a neat encapsulation of the old, like, saying that the personal is political. And, like,
mm-hmm,
so it's like, that's the sort of, like, thesis of this movie, is that the personal struggles that
it's always has been, yeah, for us,
you know, that all of, yeah, exactly, that all of our, like, queer love is inherently political. It can't be otherwise in a deeply homophobic queerphobic world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that both La Miranda and Eddie and their and Maddie Dean and their sort of their narrative, and then Bostoni and Vinny on theirs, both show in their own ways how very complicated and how much, you know, just trying to live authentically can have deeply wrenching and deeply impactful political consequences as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And like I said, I just love the character of Bostonia. I love everything about her.
Yeah, she's really good.
But I also love, you know, one of the things I think the film does particularly well, and this is why, you know, what I just alluded to, is the way that these characters, particularly Bostonia, particularly La Miranda and some of the other drag queens, they refuse to sort of obey gender. Like, that's the thing that I find most exciting, is that the film refuses to pigeonhole them as just drag queens or as trans women or any other sort of designators that we are familiar with. They just sort of move freely. Like, and I think that that's one of the things that makes them really interesting and rich characters, is that,
mm-hmm,
precisely that. That they, like, you know, as I said, Bostonia's claim that she's a chick with a dick who's not tired of the dick is really a neat encapsulation of how sometimes gender is not as clear-cut as we might like.
Yeah.
And there's even, like, preferred, I mean, for a movie made in 95, like, the allusion to, like, preferred pronouns, we can debate whether that would be, a conversation that actual characters living in 1969 might have. But mm-hmm. I actually appreciated that, because Ethan's being snide about La Miranda and refers to her as a he, and Maddie's like, she prefers she. Like, because La Miranda calls him out for it, and she's like, you know, drag queen, it's considered rude to call drag queens by he. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was a really interesting thing. And of course, La Miranda's own gender identity is itself fluid.
Yes.
Which, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, actually, when you're talking about them just kind of doing whatever they want and not being, you know, not wanting to be boxed in, because when La Miranda's trying to prove to Maddie Dean that she loves him, she becomes a man again, in terms of her dress, and it ruins her. It really, the scene is dark, literally and metaphorically. And so in the way it's like, when she tries to be anything but herself, it really is damaging, right? And it does it in such a very powerful way. And it also is a reminder internally of our community of, like, what our expectations are. You know, Maddie Dean, I don't think, is a single woman man, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Or single man, if you know what I mean. And he seems to want both Ethan and La Miranda at the same time, and then kind of gets disillusioned with Ethan. But, La Miranda, I forgot what I was going with this, but when he sees La Miranda not as herself, it's like, it kind of, like, snaps in his head that he's been kind of an asshole.
Yeah, because she lives her life authentically. Mm-hmm. You know, and I agree with you that that moment's heartbreaking, like, because you can see, however bad the acting may otherwise be, the actor playing her does that scene really well. Where,
yes, you know, I agree with that.
And you could tell that, like, adopting male drag for him has been deeply damaging. And he's like, I'll do it for you, Maddie. Like, I'll do all of these things for you, but I will never cry for anyone else. Like, mm-hmm. I won't do this for anyone else but you. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I mean, is touching and very complicated. Like, it arouses all kinds of complicated feelings in us. We're like, God, Maddie, just, like, let La Miranda live her life, you dumb asshole. Like, because, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, like, she recognizes... And she's pretty savvy, because she can see when the Mattachine goes to the Stonewall to get rejected, like, their goal being to, like, get denied service for being homosexuals, which Ethan should know better, or sorry, Maddie should know better than to take them there, but he does anyway, because he's a thoughtless.
Well, they're pretty drunk at that point, because everybody kept serving them.
Right.
Which I think is so funny.
Yeah. You know, and then La Miranda's like, well, maybe I'd like to go to the March on Philly. It's a very uncomfortable and very authentic moment, I feel like, you know, because on the one hand you have Ethan, and then on the other you have La Miranda, and then Maddie Dean's in the middle. And he's trying clearly to, like, tell La Miranda, like, you shouldn't go to this march, but without actually telling her. And it's just, it's a moment of sort of great pathos, where we kind of feel sorry for La Miranda, because she, you know, you could sense that she knows what's going on
mm-hmm.
between Ethan, but she's in, you know, it's what prompts her to be willing to go back to being a man,
right, because she knows, silly anyway, because the march is so represented so poorly that it's like, what, you shouldn't do this for,
right, as opposed to, you know, the rebellion on the night of the riot, which closes the film, which ends up being much more dynamic and powerful. And the, you know, there's the moment where the drag queens are kicked, you know, doing the sort of Rockette kind of move, and, you know, all that stuff, which is much more dynamic. They chase the cops into the Stonewall, all of which is obviously much more impactful, at least in the film's imagination, than the protest at the Philadelphia Liberty Hall.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's a good maybe move then to talk about, like, what's what I like formically about this film. Roger Stoughton to the end, you know, that it begins with a bunch of different stories about Stonewall, and then saying, this is my story about Stonewall, right? La Miranda says that. And it ends, it tells her story, and it ends when the riot starts, with her dancing, actually, in the street with the other drag queens. And what's interesting about that is it leaves us the space to be like, this is just one story, right? And what's interesting about that one story is it kind of reverberates our minds to think of, or resonates, excuse me, all the other stories that might have happened, because we do get a lot of stories in her story, right? So we think about how they're all really connected, and there are so many others. But at the same time, they're focusing on the before, not the during or after, because in some ways they want I feel like the film wants history to remember the importance of this community and what it is, and documenting that, rather than, I mean, in the beginning of the film, you hear like newsreel of somebody saying, you know, oh, the gays were going to be the rebellious ones of the 70s or something. Mm-hmm. And instead of us as fighters or something, it's really remembering us as culture and a people and a community that is driven to this, right? Instead of just like becoming hippies and like out of nowhere, you know?
Yep. I really love that reading.
Yeah. Thank you. She went to grad school.
And what I also, like, I like that your point about history, like, that's very much what this film is sort of, the history needs also to be, like, you know, has its meta-narratives and its sort of mm-hmm. the expertise, but also it's important to have these voices, like, the intimate voices of people like La Miranda, and which I think also adds an interesting gloss to the sort of breakaway moments when we have the Greek chorus, like, what's been called, like, the Greek chorus, where they, where La Miranda and Bostoni and other drag queens will perform, like, classic 1960s, like, girl band numbers, like the Ad Libs, The Boy from New York City, and all these other, and some, I think there's some from the Shangri-Las. So it's a really interesting sort of these breakaway moments that puncture the narrative, but also, like, are sort of interludes where the characters can comment in some ways on what's happening. So it's, you know, it's, again, it adds another layer to this already sort of rich tapestry of queer history. And the way the way that drag culture appropriates these songs of mainstream culture for queer purposes.
Sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, aren't a lot of Greek plays supposed to be tales of history, quote unquote?
That is correct. Many of them were about history.
So the idea of the Greek chorus is to show this is a play of history.
Yeah, and I mean, one quick thing I wanted to mention before I forget, that if, you know, readers or listeners want to learn more about the sort of pre-Stonewall history, particularly like the Mattachine and other sort of mainstream organizations, Eric Cervini's book, The Deviants War, which actually I thought of as I was watching the sort of Mattachine meetings, I was like, oh yes, a lot of the, I mean, I knew about this history before, but I mean, what I think Cervini's book does really well is to sort of highlight that. And
So if you were wondering who we kept talking about...
Yes, now is the time when we can finally talk about Cervini.
It's an academic of pre-Stonewall era.
Yes.
That's his vibe, right? He's a history.
Yeah, right? He has a degree in history, and has written a very well-regarded and highly publicized book about pre-Stonewall queer organizing.
So, yeah, go read it. Hi, Eric.
Yeah, it's good. Yes, hi, Eric Cervini. Yeah, so like I said, I love the way this film, if I were to be teaching again, you know, in a film classroom and I was teaching about queer history, I would scream this movie, because I mean, obviously it's not 100% accurate, but I do think that it at least gives you a feeling of history, of a feeling of how people might have experienced this particularly important signature moment in our history, in our collective history. Mm-hmm. And so, and like I said, I like that it's about queer people of color. Like, it's really is a mosaic of experiences that I mean, because it has the police brutality, which we see everywhere, including there's like a really gruesome moment where one of the protesters gets hit and their face hits a car window and there's blood. You know, it has the way that
that's what I was like rolling my eyes at.
It's
very dramatic.
Well, yeah. And then there's the organized crime, the way that it controlled so many of the gay bars. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the experiences of drag queens and women of and trans women of color, but also that, you know, that we're also white queers that can move in the world in different ways. The conflict with the Mattachine. So I loved that movie for that reason, that it brings so much of this out.
Yeah. Okay. You're right. I'd teach this movie.
So I think I've converted you to like this movie.
Maybe a little bit.
And isn't that what the podcast is all about? Is me enforcing my tastes on you?
Guess. I've reluctantly come to the other side of this film, I guess.
Okay, now comes the part of the show where either Mark or myself, or both, share our recollections and experiences with the movie of the week. This week, I have a deep cut, because this was obviously Mark's first time seeing it, but not mine. I've actually seen this movie 3 times, amazingly. The first time, which is the deep cut in question, I was a freshman in college. It would have been my spring semester when our gay group was hosting its annual like Pride Festival and film, like we did a mini film festival. Which we were probably breaking copyright laws, but whatever. So we, you know, if I recall correctly, that was the year we showed Shelter, I May and Jaguar, and I think this one, maybe Hedwig too. I can't remember exactly, but I do know that we showed this one. And I remember
Shelter throwback.
Not Shelter. I'm sorry. A Beautiful Thing. That's what it was. Not Shelter. Okay.
Beautiful Thing throwback.
Yeah. And I remember being, you know, struck by this movie. And I mean, keep in mind, you know, I'm 18/19. I've just come out. You know, big surprise to everyone. You know, but I've thrown myself sort of headfirst into queer culture for the first time in my entire life. You know, and so you know, I appreciated this movie for a number of reasons at the time. I loved the soundtrack, obviously, and I loved Matty Dean, who I thought was very, very cute. I don't think that as much now, but I remember just being like, "Wow!" So this is our. I mean, this was sort of like my first introduction to queer history, per se. Like, obviously, I knew I was gay, but there's a difference between understanding yourself as a gay person and understanding yourself as part of a community and as part of a history. And so I think that's what this film provided a very young, you know, teenage gay TJ, was that sense of what had come before that I had not had prior to that. And so, I mean, maybe that's why I have so much affection for it and why, you know, it sort of stands out to me as one of the better representations of this pivotal event and it's, you know, what led up to it. And so that's why I'm willing to go to bat for it. And I was actually kind of worried when I watched it this time, because I watched it last time, probably was 2011, so about a decade ago was probably the last time I watched it with my partner at the time. You know, I liked it then too. And so I was kind of afraid when I watched it this time that maybe a little bit of the sheen had gone, especially after you said, you know, you didn't like it. And I thought, oh no, is this going to be one of those tragic cases where I watch something and it's not what I enjoyed before? But as it turns out, no. In fact, my appreciation of it is richened and deepened because now I finished my PhD in film. I've written a lot more about queer history. I've read a lot more about queer history. And so I think now I have a more intellectually rich understanding of this movie and appreciation for this movie. But I think that makes a nice layer on top of the foundational sort of emotional and, you know, deeply personal investment that I have in it from my own early days as a gay person. And this being one of the first gay movies that I watched among other gay people, which I think is important. Because obviously it wasn't just me. I was watching it with other queer people who were in the process of inducting me into how to be gay, to paraphrase, a book written by David Halperin. Like, one is not born gay in that sense. Like, you become gay by learning about your history and about the sort of contours of gay culture and sensibility. And so this film was really pivotal in that regard for me. And so I think that's why I'm so willing to go to bat for it.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. I want to go to a gay film festival. I was at the Tribeca Film Festival a bit ago, and I had so much fun. And now I want to go back.
Yeah. Like I said, I think that the communal experience is really pivotal to the, especially, I mean, it's always, I think that there is something to be said for the communal experience of watching a movie, but I think it's especially important for gay people, especially now in the aftermath of the pandemic. And as we talked about in our Pride episode, like, you know, the decline of gay bars and the sort of atomization of gay people. I think that, you know, screening movies like Stonewall that have a history message becomes even more impactful when it's done in a room full of gay people that are sharing this
experience. Yeah, of course, because, yeah, we're creating community and watching it at the same time. Yeah, of course, it's like a whole thing. Maybe we could do more of that.
Yeah, we should. Maybe one day when we're, you know, when our podcast has become a phenomenon.
Yeah, make us famous so we can start a film festival.
Yep, that is the goal, yeah.
Yeah,
We have, just so our listeners know, we want to express our gratitude. You have boosted us over 700 downloads.
Yes.
Since we began this pod back in October. So that's really great, and we're very thankful to all of you who continue to tune in after every two weeks to hear ours.
We love that. Thank you.
We do. We love our fans.
Yeah. Let's make it 1,000.
Let's get it over the hump before September.
Yeah. So, now is the time for my favorite segment, a segment we do every week, Are You Even Gay? And this week, I have something for TJ that I found while watching his very, very favorite movie, Stonewall, in which he has seen three times now. I had never seen before. And when I watched it and was like, oh, I have an argument gay for him, I was so excited. And I refused to tell him up until this moment. So this is live, listeners. I'm so excited. And I know that you're not going to know it.
Out with it. What is it?
Excuse me. Let me build it up.
What a drama queen this Leah is.
It's an Are You Even Gay for You, but it's also an Are You Even Gay for an entire generation of people that I, you know, have made fun of me before. So this is like, this is at the Gen Zs as well. So I found out that during one of the Greek choruses, there is a song that, actually it's not necessarily a Greek chorus fully, but La Miranda sings it when Maddie Dean is on Fire Island with Ethan. It is a song, it's by the Shangri-Las, which is when you said you knew the Shangri-Las, I was like, oh my god. But it's by the Shangri-Las, called Remember Walking in the Sand. And for the young listeners, they may know that this is what I call a TikTok jingle. I don't know if you've heard this TikTok jingle, TJ, but it is literally in the movie, and it's when they go, oh no, oh no, oh no, 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 no. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So that is a TikTok jingle that the kids use when things go wrong. Yes, it's like used from that. And so originally a Shangri-La song, right?
Well, yeah,
but I thought it was so amazing that it was in Stonewall the movie, and all the little like Gen Z queer, you know, sensitive queer types probably don't even know that that's where it's from, looking at you guys.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah.
Well, that's something I did not know, because I've never used TikTok and never will. Maybe we should, to get our publicity up, but whatever.
I mean, I'm not going to do it, but you can. I'll tell my boyfriend.
Is he on TikTok?
Yeah, he loves the TikTok.
Why am I not surprised? But
that's how I know about all these TikToks.
Ugh. Just so our listeners know, when Mark starts hyping up our generational divide, he's still a millennial, and so am I, so I don't want to hear it. Like, for all of his flattering of
TJ, himself. I have a question for you. Are you even gay?
Oh, honey, I was gay before you were born.
I mean, that's true. Literally.
Definitely true.
Yeah. I was just, oh, God, what a, I felt, so you know when you, like, feel cool for, like, 1 second? I really just felt cool.
I've heard that as a feeling one can have, yes.
Yeah, I felt cool. And then Josh, my boyfriend, for the listeners, was like, you're not cool. And I said, I am cool. I'm so cool. I found this.
We have a very popular podcast, so we are the definition of cool.
That's right. Exactly.
Academia meets fun, as one of our iTunes, generous iTunes raters put us. So,
really? I didn't know that.
Yes.
Clearly I don't read it, but
yeah. I keep an eagle eye on our ratings.
That's great. Academia meets fun.
That is our aesthetic. That is our thing. That's our shtick.
But yeah, I was so impressed with myself.
I'm sure they have, like I said, like you said, they have no idea that it's the Shangri-Las. I have no doubt at all that they don't even know who the Shangri-Las are.
I mean,
still less than it was used in this movie.
I know, it was crazy. I was just like, wow.
I mean, the Shangri-Las were a very, very popular group.
Yeah, just I know who the Shangri-Las are. So,
well, I know, but you're a little more conversant with previous moments of culture.
This podcast might beg to differ at certain.
Well,
points.
I mean, you didn't watch Designing Women, The Golden Girls, or The Nanny, so I really do have to wonder what the fuck you were watching as a kid. But that's neither here nor there.
SpongeBob.
Well, that's pretty
cool. Imaginary Friends. I don't know. Like Mad TV. Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends is very good. All right, I'm not going to hear this garbage from you right now. All right, it's great. It's a cartoon about orphaned imaginary friends.
I've seen it.
And their antics.
About.
Well,
it's not nearly. I was expecting something a little more humorous, but it was not very humorous.
I was a big fan of Toonami. I was a weird queer, you know.
Obviously.
That. Yeah. I just grew into a basic one.
Well, I was born basic. Well, thank you all for joining us for another fantabulous episode of Queens of the Bees. We, as always, we do want to express our sincerest gratitude to all of our regular listeners who have been kind enough to, you know, leave us some ratings on Apple and just tuning in every week and downloading our podcast. Mm-hmm. That really means a lot. I mean, it goes without saying, perhaps, but we just feel it's important that we acknowledge that we wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for all of you. And we really, really appreciate all of your support, both, as I said, in terms of downloads and ratings, but also just in terms of just being there and reaching out to us. But we would also reiterate that if you could give us a rating on Apple, every rating definitely helps build our visibility. And that's really important for a little podcast like ours that don't have the huge following just yet.
Yes. Rate us on Apple Podcasts, please.
And everywhere else.
Tell your friends.
Yeah, tell your friends. You know, we're not just for the queers. I mean, that's obviously our primary audience, but we also love the straights too. The normies. So, Mark, why don't you tell us where we can find you on social media?
You can find me on Instagram at MusterTheCourage and on Twitter at MusterTheCourage without the E. And TJ, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at TJ West and the number 3. So just TJ West 3. On Instagram at Thomas West 3. And then you can also look at our blog, our Medium public on Medium, which is also titled Queens of the Bees. If you just go, type in Queens of the Bees Medium, it'll take you right there. It will have some write-ups of the films we've talked about, but we also talk about a lot of other queer culture issues. We definitely invite all of you to see what else we're chatting up about in the written world. And also don't forget that you can also donate to our podcast. We don't mind doing this for free, but a little bit of money wouldn't hurt either. So if you want to click on the donate button, you can find it through our Buzzsprout website. Each episode has the little donate button.
Mm-hmm. And as always, Eric Cervini, if you're listening, we would love to have you on the pod.
We would indeed.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Bye all.